Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles from the Internet edition of the Atlantic, all of them published in March of 2025. I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this article, The Rise of the Brutal American. This is How the Bad Guys Act, by Ann Applebaum. A book festival in Vilnius, meetings with friends in Warsaw, a dinner in Berlin. I happened to be at gatherings in three European cities over the past several days, and everywhere I went, everyone wanted to talk about the Oval Office performance last Friday. Europeans needed some time to process this event, not just because of what it told them about the war in Ukraine, but because of what it told them about America, a country they thought they knew well. In just a few minutes, the behavior of Donald Trump and J.D. Vance created a brand new stereotype for America. Not the quiet American, not the ugly American, but the brutal American. Whatever illusions Europeans ever had about Americans, whatever images lingered from old American movies, the ones where the good guys win, the bad guys lose, and honor defeats treachery, those are shattered. Whatever fond memories remain of the smiling GIs who marched into European cities in 1945, of the speeches that John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan made at the Berlin Wall, or of the crowds that once welcomed Barack Obama, those are also fading fast. Quite apart from their politics, Trump and Vance are rude. They are cruel. They berated and mistreated a guest on camera, and then boasted about it afterward, as if their ugly behavior achieved some kind of macho win. They announced that they would halt transfers of military equipment to Ukraine and hinted at ending sanctions on Russia, the aggressor state. In his speech to Congress last night, Trump once again declared that America would get Greenland, which is part of Denmark, a sign that he intends to run roughshod over other allies, too. These are the actions not of the good guys in old Hollywood movies, but of the bad guys. If Reagan was a white-hatted cowboy, Trump and Vance are mafia dons. The chorus of Republican political leaders defending them seems both sinister and surprising to Europeans, too. I never thought Americans would kowtow like that, one friend told me, marveling. The Oval Office meeting, the subsequent announcements, and the speech to Congress also clarified something else. Trump, Vance, and many of the people around them now fully inhabit an alternative reality, one composed entirely of things they see and hear in the ether. Part of the Oval Office altercation was provoked by Zelensky's insistence on telling the truth, as the full video clearly shows. His mistake was to point out that Russia and Ukraine have reached many ceasefires and made many agreements since 2014, and that Vladimir Putin has broken most of them, including during Trump's first term. It's precisely because they remember these broken truces that the Ukrainians keep asking what happens after a ceasefire. What kind of security guarantees will be put in place? How Trump plans to prevent Putin from breaking them once more? And above all, what price the Russians are willing to pay for peace in Ukraine? Will they even give up their claims to territory they don't control? Will they agree that Ukraine can be a sovereign democracy? But Trump and Vance are not interested in the truth about the war in Ukraine. Trump seemed angered by the suggestion that Putin might break deals with him, refused to acknowledge that it's happened before, falsely insisted, again, that the U.S. had given Ukraine $350 billion. Vance, who had refused to meet Zelensky when offered the opportunity before the election last year, told the Ukrainian president that he didn't need to go to Ukraine to understand what is going on in his country. "I've actually watched and seen the stories," he said, meaning that he has seen the, quote, stories curated for him by the people he follows on YouTube or X. Europeans can also see that the alternative reality is directly and profoundly shaped by Russian propaganda. I don't know whether the American president absorbs Russian narratives online, from proxies or from Putin himself. Either way, he has thoroughly adopted the Russian view of the world, as has Vance. This is not new. Back in 2016, at the height of the election campaign, Trump frequently repeated false stories launched by Russia's Sputnik news agency, declaring that Hillary Clinton and Obama had, quote, founded ISIS, or that, quote, the Google search engine is suppressing the bad news about Hillary Clinton, end quote. At the time, Trump also imitated Russian talk about Clinton starting World War III, another Russian meme. He produced a new version of that in the Oval Office on Friday. "You're gambling with World War III. You're gambling with World War III," he shouted at Zelensky. But what was ominous in 2016 is dangerous in 2025, especially in Europe. Russian military aggression is more damaging, Russian sabotage across Europe more frequent, and Russian cyber attacks almost constant. In truth, it is Putin, not Zelensky, who started this conflict. Putin, who has brought North Korean troops and Iranian drones to Europe. Putin, who instructs his propagandist to talk about nuking London. Putin, who keeps raising the stakes and scope of the war. Most Europeans live in this reality, not in the fictional world inhabited by Trump, and the contrast is making them think differently about Americans. According to pollsters, nearly three-quarters of French people now think that the U.S. is not an ally of France. A majority in Britain and a very large majority in Denmark, both historically pro-American countries, now have unfavorable views of the U.S. as well. In reality, the Russians have said nothing publicly about leaving Ukrainian territory or stopping the war. In reality, they have spent the past decade building a cult of cruelty at home. Now they have exported that cult not just to Europe, not just to Africa, but to Washington too. This administration abruptly canceled billions of dollars of food aid and health care programs for the poorest people on the planet, a vicious act that the president and vice president have not acknowledged, but that millions of people can see. Their use of tariffs as random punishment, not for enemies but for allies, seems not just brutal, but inexplicable. And in the Oval Office, Trump and Vance behaved like imperial rulers, chastising a subjugated colony, vocalizing the same disgust and disdain that Russian propagandists use when they talk about Ukraine. Europeans know, everyone knows, that if Trump and Vance can talk that way to the president of Ukraine, then they might eventually talk that way to their country's leader next. That completes the first article today, The Rise of the Brutal American, by Atlantic staff writer Ann Applebaum. The next article is, No One Wins a Trade War. Protective tariffs risk triggering a cycle of escalation that ends well for no one, by William Bernstein. Donald Trump is fond of saying that trade wars are easy to win. Among the litany of patently false Trumpisms, this may well prove one of the most disastrous. Last week, Trump claimed that his threatened and deferred 25% tariffs on Mexico and Canada will finally go into effect tomorrow. He also said that existing 10% tariffs on Chinese goods will double. Whether he's bluffing is anyone's guess. Protective tariffs risk triggering a cycle of escalation that ends well for no one. First comes increased consumer prices. The general public well understands that tariffs worsen inflation. The mere expectation of inflation tomorrow drives inflation today, and consumers have already begun stockpiling goods in anticipation of higher prices. Worse, tariffs increase the costs of foreign materials inputs for domestic manufacturers and make their products uncompetitive abroad. Think of the U.S. auto industry's consumption of foreign steel and aluminum, newly subject to substantial import levies. Next, foreign trading partners retaliate with tariffs of their own, further reducing the international competitiveness of domestic manufacturers. Finally, tariffs strengthen the dollar, which makes American products yet more expensive abroad. As former Secretary of State Cordell Hull once put it, quote, a prohibitive protective tariff is a gun that recoils upon ourselves, end quote. And that's just the economic damage. Trade wars can and do evolve into shooting wars. Today's globalization discontent begins with Henry Bessemer. His blast furnace, invented in 1858, slashed the cost of high-quality steel. Prior to Bessemer, the cost of overland transport was prohibitive. The iron steam engines of the early 19th century were so weak that they occasionally needed a push start, and iron tracks supported relatively little weight and wore out quickly. Until the late 19th century, a productive wheat farm or cattle ranch more than 30 miles from a port could sell its produce only locally. Within decades of Bessemer's invention, cheap grain from the American hinterlands and affordable meat carried in refrigerated ships from the Argentine Pampas overwhelmed European markets. Well into the 20th century, most Frenchmen and Germans worked on the farm. They were savaged by the flood of cheap foreign produce and soon demanded and obtained protective tariffs, which triggered a global trade war lasting decades. On the other side of the Atlantic, advanced farm machinery increased American farm productivity and yielded bumper crops that drove down grain prices. Hard-pressed farmers mistakenly identified foreign competition as the culprit. The ultimate result was the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. Even a century ago, economists well understood tariffs' corrosive effects. On May 30, 1930, President Herbert Hoover was presented with a petition signed by 1,028 economists, urging him to veto the bill. Quote, a higher level of protection, they wrote, would raise the cost of living and injure the great majority of our citizens. End of quote. To no avail, Hoover signed it 18 days later. In the event the economic damage from Smoot-Hawley turned out to be relatively mild, At that time, international trade consisted only or constituted only 9% of America's GDP, and the one-third falloff in global commerce, mitigated by the replacement of foreign goods by more expensive domestic ones, meant that the tariffs were responsible for just 1 or 2% of the Great Depression's approximately 30% GDP drop. The law proved calamitous nonetheless by corroding the political and moral intangibles of trade that John Stuart Mill had eloquently described more than a century earlier. Quote, "Commerce first taught nations to see with goodwill the wealth and prosperity of one another. Before, the patriot, unless sufficiently advanced to feel the world his country, wished all countries weak, poor, and ill-governed but his own. He now sees in their wealth and progress a direct source of wealth and progress to his own country." End quote. Smoot-Hawley wrought fearsome geopolitical turbulence. American products suffered boycotts. Americans abroad found themselves the recipients of personal insults, and the world's foreign ministry erupted in protest. Crucially, the act crippled Germany's ability to export its way out of the onerous Versailles reparations. Few understood the connection between the period's trade wars and the Second World War's cataclysm better than the Jewish economic historian Albert Hirschman. As a young man, he had fled Germany, fought in the French army, and helped smuggle refugees out of Nazi-occupied Marseille. Looking back, he wrote that trade wars undoubtedly sharpen national antagonisms. They also provide excellent opportunity for nationalist leaders to arouse popular resentment. International economic relations provide them with an excellent instrument to achieve their ends. During the first half of the 20th century, patriots around the world less and less felt, in Mill's words, the world their country. America's leaders learned the hard way that protection invites retaliation, and not only the economic kind. Imagine, for example, a tense encounter today between U.S. and Chinese naval forces in the Taiwan Strait. The difference between war and peace may well hinge on the mental state and persuasiveness of hardliners on both sides, angered by trade tensions. In 1945, America's leaders understood the importance of dismantling the previous decade's tariff walls. The eventual result, proposals for expansion of world trade and employment, laid the foundation for today's globalized economy. Its drafters, a disparate group of American officials led by Undersecretary of State for Economic Affairs William L. Clayton, shared Hirschman's assessment of the 1930s trade war. They also realized that with so many nations in shambles, they had a limited and temporary power to establish the world we want to live in. Their labor yielded the backbone of today's global order, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and the multiple General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade rounds that drove the worldwide tariff average of nearly 30% in 1945 to about 5% today. Economic historians have long known that free trade does not lift all boats. Trade's bounty is diffuse and at times difficult to discern, but its costs, as experienced by European farmers in the 19th century and by American factory workers today, are concentrated and acute. A decade ago, research by the economist David Aurer and his colleagues made clear that American communities most exposed to competition from Chinese imports had suffered higher unemployment, forced retirements, and increased health care and disability costs. Conventional economic theory predicts that displaced workers will retrain or move to places with more jobs. Not so. Those who lost their jobs to Chinese competition rarely regained high-paying work. Rather, they remained in place and either retired or collected disability payments. Otter's recent update paints an even bleaker picture. Although employment eventually rebounded, it came from lower-paying service sector jobs filled by the young and by immigrants. Even so, the broad benefits of free trade, which accrue to an enormous share of the world's population, far outweigh the concentrated harms. In that sense, the free trade system is, as Winston Churchill quipped of democracy, the worst form of economics, except for all the others that have been tried from time to time. The potential for tariff-driven economic damage is, in fact, now greater than in the 1930s. Not only has the share of the world's GDP flowing through trade tripled since then, but today's complex supply chains, which see even T-shirts whizzing among continents multiple times before sale to consumers, add fragility to the world economy. And that's the good news. As the dismal history of the 20th century's first half demonstrated, the price of tariffs put in place by men who did not consider the world their country can mushroom far beyond mere accounting. One key difference between the 1930s economy and today's might prevent a full-blown trade war from erupting. In the era of Smoot-Hawley, only the wealthiest few percent of Americans owned stocks and bonds. Today, a large majority of workers and retirees own these assets in their 401k plans and IRAs, and are thus sensitive to protectionism's economic threat. The past few months have seen stock and bond market ructions that vary with how seriously investors take the president's tariff policies. The threat of interest rate spikes and Dow shudders might explain why Trump has so far stopped well short of imposing the huge global tariffs he promised during his 2024 campaign, and why he backed away from the ledge in his first go-around with Mexico and Canada. During his first term, Trump was often mocked for equating the performance of the stock market with the health of the economy. During his second, that tendency might be what saves us all from catastrophe. That's the end of the article. The author, William Bernstein, is the author of several books about finance and history, including The Four Pillars of Investing and A Splendid Exchange. His article was titled, No One Wins a Trade War. I'll take a moment to remind those of you that may have tuned in late, this is the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by SunSounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your SunSounds volunteer reader today. I'm reading from the online edition of The Atlantic. All of the articles have been published in March of 2025. The next article is titled, America's Cultural Revolution: What Trump's Takeover of the Kennedy Center Really Means, by Stephen March. The takeover of the Kennedy Center may seem like an afterthought in the furious drama of President Donald Trump's first month in office. The abandonment of the Transatlantic Alliance, proposals to annex territory on multiple continents, the evisceration of national institutions, and overt claims to kingship are such eye-popping departures from precedent that the leadership of a somewhat stuffy, self-consciously elite performing arts venue seems negligible by comparison. But Trump's particular preoccupation with the Kennedy Center is symptomatic of a profound change in the nature of American power since his inauguration. America is undergoing a cultural revolution. "This is going to be great television," Trump said at the end of Friday's stormy session with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. It may as well be the motto of his administration. It is a new kind of cultural revolution. Unlike the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century, which imposed ideology on their populaces by means of culture and entertainment, America's current reality is the overturning of the political order by the country's entertainers. The American culture industry has overwhelmed politics. Washington today can be understood only as a product of show business, not of law or policy. The Trump administration has been consistent in its veneration of show business, if in nothing else. The president has put a WWE executive in charge of education, made a Fox News talking head his Secretary of Defense, installed a celebrity conspiracy theorist to lead the National Institutes of Health, handed control of Medicare to a TV doctor, and appointed a right-wing podcaster as deputy director of the FBI. Elon Musk is running government reform because he can live post it. Dr. Phil accompanies ICE on raids. Trump's cabinet picks resemble the cast of a reality television show by design. Trump understands by instinct and through experience that the line between entertainment and power in American life has effectively dissolved. In his farewell address, President Joe Biden described the incoming administration as an oligarchy. He was mistaken. It is rule by performers, a histriocracy. Anyone who wants to understand what is happening in American politics needs to understand it on those terms. In 2016, a reality TV star's rise to the presidency was novel, and seeing that surprise triumph as an anomaly was still possible. No longer. The 2024 election was not just evidence of a rightward shift among traditionally Democratic voters or of rising anti-government patriotism, but a clarification of how fundamentally American politics has shifted the ground from which its meaning derives. Politics has become an offshoot of spectacle. Trump has left intellectuals grasping for historical analogies. Is he a fascist or a populist? Is he a latter-day know-nothing or a modern demagogue? The analogies are unsatisfying because they fail to account for popular culture as a political force, the way it has scrambled traditional dividing lines. Trump has Orthodox Jewish grandchildren and is a hero to the white power movement. He won a record percentage of Arab American votes, then appointed an ambassador to Israel who claims that there is no such thing as Palestinians. He enjoys fervent support among evangelicals, despite the fact that his character is a living contradiction of every value they revere. These paradoxes would not be possible in a politics that selects the country's leadership on the basis of ideas and character. They make sense if brute exposure determines who wins. as the grand soap opera of this American presidency unfolds, displays of rage and wonder fill every moment. Get-rich-quick schemes, rigged games, vengeful punishments. The audience is hurried from one hustle to another. The distinction between a con and a joke has blurred. The great circus showman P.T. Barnum prophesied the rise of Trump when he declared, "Let me furnish the amusements of a nation, and there will be need of very few laws." The connection between Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and John F. Kennedy is more than genetic. Norman Mailer, in his famous essay on the 1960 Democratic Convention, "Superman Comes to the Supermarket," noticed a mysterious sadness that gripped the spectators, which made sense only when he saw the future President Kennedy in the flesh. The Democrats were going to nominate a man who, no matter how serious his political dedication might be, was indisputably and willy-nilly going to be seen as a great box office actor. And the consequences of that were staggering and not at all easy to calculate. Trump's cabinet is the staggering consequence that Mailer could not calculate. Ronald Reagan in the 1980s made the connection between celebrity and power even more explicit. He rose after a career in which perhaps his most famous role was starring opposite a chimpanzee. The great communicator told corny jokes and knew that television was everything. The Republican Party won one for the Gipper, as Reagan's campaign slogan had it. When his administration abolished the Fairness Doctrine in 1987, releasing news media from any obligation of impartiality, it prepared the way for histriocracy without government interference. Rule by performers is distinct from autocracy. The ruling performers serve the narrative needs of their fans first and foremost. Policy will always be an addendum to the show. The overturning of Roe v. Wade had compelling emotional heft for Trump's base, a soul-stirring final scene to the movie that had been playing in their minds for generations. "We beat the cosmopolitan elite to save babies." The happy ending was that abortion became illegal in much of the United States. But winning for show is very different from having a desired effect on the world. Since 2018, the rate of abortions has, by most accounts, kept rising. Not that anybody seems to care, because the narrative impulse is the primary political driver. In fact, the restrictionist policy's failure provides an opportunity for endless sequels. Trump has served the pro-life movement's storyline needs by creating the conditions for an increase in abortion numbers. So many more bad people to punish. So many more babies who need saving. In a politics determined by performance, outcomes are epilogues that nobody reads. The reality of rule by performers is profoundly disconcerting to American intellectuals' self-conception of their government's dignity. This is the message of the Kennedy Center's takeover that D.C. political elite has been slow to register. If you think it's a joke to have RFK Jr. in office, that's the point. Jokes gather attention. Attention creates exposure. Exposure drives power. The greatest asset for any politician today is a bottomless narcissism that requires unremitting attention to satisfy. Rule by performers doesn't need to impose an autocrat's lies on the people. People do it to themselves through their entertainments. In 1984, George Orwell described doublethink as the kind of intellectual gymnastics demanded by a totalitarian society. Quote, to tell deliberate lies while genuinely believing in them, to forget any fact that has become inconvenient, and then when it becomes necessary again, to draw it back from oblivion for just so long as it is needed, to deny the existence of objective reality, and all the while to take account of the reality which one denies. End quote. Reality television and the WWE demand similar distortion effect gymnastics. Their audiences willingly suspend their disbelief and gladly accept events they know are artificial as real. The audiences come to political debate, already prepared for the blurring of illusion and reality. The public appears disposed to be amused, even when they are conscious of being deceived. Barnum understood, which is why they called him the Prince of Humbugs. In Trump, they have a king. As forewarned, America has amused itself to death. Histriocracy is much less stable than traditional autocracy. Wilder, more unpredictable. Turbulence is to be expected, as creating drama is the point of the government and the source of power. No doubt the kidney center will be consumed by a whirlwind of thrills and chills over the next 4 years. But when a circus departs, it leaves behind dirty streets, empty pockets, and lingering regrets. Under rule by performers, only one law is inviolable. The show must go on until the curtain falls. That's the end of the article. The author, Stephen March, is the author of The Next Civil War. The name of his article was America's Cultural Revolution. The next article is titled, Why It Matters, Who Asks the Questions? When the White House handpicks reporters to cover the president, the American public suffers, by Jonathan Lemire. Kim Jong-un stared blankly as I spoke. The North Korean dictator was seated across a small table from President Donald Trump, the two leaders and their entourages tucked away in a meeting room of a luxury hall in Hanoi, Vietnam. It was their second summit, this one in February 2019, an event that the United States hoped would de-escalate the threat posed by the rogue nuclear nation, and one that Trump had told aides might yield him a Nobel Peace Prize. But I wanted to ask the president about something on the other side of the globe. Mr. President, do you have any reaction to Michael Cohen and his testimony? I asked from a few feet away. Trump scowled and shook his head. Kim didn't react. The dozen other American reporters who were there and I were abruptly pulled from the room. And when the summit later adjourned without a deal, Trump blamed the stalled negotiations on the distractions caused by Cohen, his former lawyer, who had appeared before a Democratic-led congressional committee back in Washington hours earlier, and delivered explosive testimony in which he labeled Trump a racist, con man, and cheat. Trump later told aides on Air Force One that he didn't like my question, and certainly he had the right to respond to it however he saw fit, or to choose not to respond at all. But most important was that I had the ability to ask it at all, that a journalist protected by the freedom of speech could directly challenge the president about any subject of his or her choosing. I was able to do so that day only because I was part of what's known as the White House press pool. Established during the Eisenhower administration, the pool is a small, rotating group of journalists who stand in for the rest of the press corps when security or space limitations prevent a larger number of reporters and photographers from being present. For example, in the Oval Office, on Air Force One, or in this case, in a small room in Vietnam. Across generations of Democratic and Republican presidencies, the pool system has, with remarkable speed, kept the American public informed about what the president is doing on a daily basis. In his first term, Trump went along with the system. But this week, he made clear that he no longer would. The White House press secretary announced that the administration would disband the daily rotation, long coordinated by the White House Correspondents Association, and instead hand-pick which journalists would be allowed to follow the president. The change might seem trivial to many Americans, just a Beltway insider controversy or a fight among celebrity correspondents jockeying over who has access to the president. But it represents a dangerous moment for American democracy. If, as it has begun to do, the White House gives preference to Trump-friendly outlets, it will restrict the ability of fair, independent journalists to hold some of the most powerful people on the planet to account and to expose the president's actions and decisions. Our job is to push the president beyond his comfort space and to respond to questions that otherwise they're never asked. Peter Baker, the longtime New York Times correspondent who has covered the White House since 1996, told me. Now he's sending a signal that if you write something we don't like, you're out. You don't get to be here anymore. The announcement this week follows the White House's recent banishment of the Associated Press from the pool and White House events after the outlet refused to go along with Trump's executive order renaming the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. AP journalists have been allowed to keep their hard passes, security clearances that allow them access to the White House campus. But they are clearly being punished by the president for the words they used to cover him. The White House Correspondents Association, which represents the journalists who report on the day-to-day doings of the president and works with the West Wing to facilitate press access, objected to the decision. The AP, in a statement, said the move plainly violates the First Amendment and is suing the White House over the ban. A federal judge this week did not offer an immediate ruling, but also did not restore the outlet's access, causing the Trump administration to claim victory. I worked at the AP for 8 years, including while on that presidential trip to Vietnam, and am a member of the WHCA. By overriding the entire pool system, the White House has now gone one step further. The WHCA represents nearly 300 news organizations from a wide range of ideological viewpoints, including conservative ones, that are accredited to cover the president. It has long determined the identities of the outlets and reporters in the pool, with no input from the White House. About 36 outlets rotate on an alphabetical basis pool duties at the White House. a smaller number participate in what's known as the travel pool, following the president when he leaves White House grounds, because of the costs involved. The media organizations themselves cover those costs, not taxpayers. When he travels, 13 journalists, a mix of correspondents, photographers, and technicians, go along with him, because that's how many seats are in the press cabin of Air Force One. When the president is at the White House, the number increases slightly. In both cases, those in the pool send out information through reports that are distributed directly to the other members of the WHCA. On Tuesday, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt announced that the White House would no longer use the WHCA's rotation. The next day, Reuters joined AP in losing its scheduled shift. Blaze Media, a conservative outlet making its debut in the pool, and Axios, one of the few outlets to adopt the Gulf of America name, were allowed in. Today, two more partisan, right-leaning outlets, One American News and The Federalist, received pool slots. And a reporter from the Russian state news agency TASS was allowed to gain access to today's Oval Office meeting between Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, while the AP and Reuters were not. That reporter was later removed by staffers for not being on the approved list, according to the White House. This move tears at the independence of a free press in the United States. Eugene Daniels, the president of WHCA's board and a Politico correspondent, soon leaving to host an MSNBC show, said in a statement earlier this week, "It suggests the government will choose the journalists who cover the president. In a free country, leaders must not be able to choose their own press corps." The White House did not respond to requests for comments for this article. The mere presence of the pool is important. Its reporters stand poised at just about any moment to provide the nation with real-time updates on the president's actions and health. The pool is there if the president travels to Boston or Beijing or just up Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol. It has been on hand for some of the nation's most historic moments, including when John F. Kennedy was shot in Dallas and when George W. Bush was scrambled into the Florida skies after hijacked planes struck the World Trade Center. It has been there when presidents make unannounced trips to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Ukraine. And it's there for mundane moments, too, with reporters sometimes sitting for hours in vans while the president golfs. The pool's purpose is not just stenography about what the president says or a daily diary of what he does. Pool reports, compiled by independent journalists and untouched by any government officials, are often full of answers to unsparing questions posed by pool reporters. Trump feeds off media attention and, at times, enjoys going back and forth with reporters. He is accessible to the press and answers far more questions than his immediate predecessors. But most of the questions he fields are in spontaneous sessions with members of the pool, in the Oval Office, in the Cabinet Room, or on the tarmac at Joint Base Andrews. He takes far fewer questions in larger news conference settings, with the full press corps, and he doesn't regularly sit for one-on-one interviews other than with friendly, right-leaning interlocutors. If the pool is now stacked with right-wing journalists, Trump will face fewer challenging questions, a blow to transparency and Americans' ability to keep tabs on the most powerful person in their government. Ron Fornier, who covered the White House for the AP for more than a decade, beginning in 1993, describes such a system to me as state media. That is not a democracy, Fournier said. If this precedent holds, every future president will want the same deal. The changes to the pool system are all the more worrying because they are part of a larger attack on the press from the White House. No president likes his media coverage, but no one before Trump has made the press such a part of the story. Trump has long deemed journalists the enemy of the people, while deriding institutions and individual reporters, me included, and he has successfully inspired fear in the Fourth Estate. His litigation prompted ABC to pay $15 million to his presidential library in a settlement. His Federal Communications Commission has opened investigations into PBS, NPR, and the parent company of NBC. Trump threatened this week to sue members of the media over anonymous sources, claiming that, quote, a big price should be paid for stories he doesn't like. The Pentagon has told reporters that it will eliminate its own pool that travels with the defense secretary. And before taking office, Trump's FBI director mused about targeting journalists he believes have covered the president unfairly. The WHCA circulated a letter this week that was signed by 39 outlets protesting the changes to the pool. Some right-leaning organizations, such as Fox News and Newsmax, signed the letter, warning that a future Democratic president might exclude conservative media outlets. Newsmax's owner, Chris Ruddy, made that case to Levitt yesterday. A person familiar with the meeting told me. The press secretary was unmoved by the argument, the person said. Ruddy did not immediately respond to a request for comment. She has stated publicly that the changes to the pool will allow a more diverse set of outlets to cover the president. In response to a social media post from Baker, the New York Times correspondent, criticizing the move, Levitt wrote, "Gone are the days when left-wing stenographers posing as journalists, such as yourself, dictate who gets to ask what." Members of the WHCA board continued negotiations with the White House yesterday. Reporters have speculated that Trump will get bored of softball questions from friendly outlets, or that the White House will tire of shouldering the logistics of staging press events without the WHCA's help. Some of the White House correspondents I have talked to in recent days have floated the idea of boycotting covering Trump events in protest, but others, including members of TV networks, have pushed back on the idea. Among the fears that a boycott could cause the White House to fully stock the pool with sycophantic outlets, or to disband it completely. Some rank-and-file WHCA members have also advocated for canceling the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the annual black tie celebration of the First Amendment scheduled for late April, because of the bad optics that would be produced by scenes of correspondents mingling with administration officials who have cut back on press access. But calling off the event would deprive the organization of its best yearly opportunity to raise money for journalism scholarships and operating expenses. For now, the dinner is on. Although presidents are always invited, Trump did not attend the event during any of his first 4 years in office. A White House official, speaking on the condition of anonymity to discuss private conversations, told me that Trump had not decided whether to attend this year's dinner, but that many of his aides were urging him to go, to make clear that he owns you. That completes the article. The author, Jonathan Lemire, is a contributing writer at The Atlantic. He serves as co-host for MSNBC's Morning Joe. The title of his article was Why It Matters, Who Asks the Questions. And that completes the program for today. This has been The Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I hope you enjoyed the program. I've been reading articles from the online edition of The Atlantic, all of them published in March of 2025. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you've missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio. On the next page, click on the words Demand Podcasts. Then you'll see a list of programs. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.